nominated for the 2022 Nobel Peace Prize. Walk me through and what that feels like.
Scott, it was a shock first.
Today, my guest is Keith Kroc.
Former U.S. Undersecretary of State for Economic Growth, Energy, and the Environment. The first and highest ranking State Department official who had the guts and the strength to visit Taiwan, even under China threat. He was the first official in the U.S. to do that since 1979.
The things that you deployed in Taiwan in particular, why does that tie back to the impact that China could have on the U.S.?
Taiwan is a linchpin for democracy and a role model of freedom. That's what they are to the free world. Now, to General Secretary Xi, what they are is they dispel his myth that the Chinese culture cannot live under a democracy, but it has to live under authoritarian rule, and he wants it.
Talk about the current state of China, what they have under their control, what they're trying to do. How does that impact us? Yeah. How do we fight back against that?
I got asked by Senator Coons, and he said, Keith, what would your strategy be to combat China's economic aggression? And I said,
welcome to Success Story. I'm your host, Scott Clary. The Success Story podcast is part of the HubSpot podcast network. Now, the HubSpot podcast network has incredible podcasts like My First Million, hosted by Sam Parr and Sean Puri. They interview some of the most incredible business leaders, Alex Hormozi, Sophia Amoruso, Hassan Minhaj, who share their journey to success and how they made their first million. On a recent episode, they featured the acquired podcast hosts, Ben Gilbert and David Rosenthal, to discuss how they scaled their multi-million dollar podcast. Don't sleep on My First Million. If you want to get inspired, if you want to learn from the best, you got to tune into My First Million wherever you listen to your podcast. Today, my guest is Keith Kroc. Keith is a former U.S. Undersecretary of State, as well as the CEO of DocuSign and Ariba. He's been nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize in recognition of his work defending against Chinese techno-authoritarianism and leveraging the United States' technology advancements towards a new form of diplomacy. He's inaugurated the Kroc Institute for Tech Diplomacy at Purdue. They address emerging challenges such as artificial intelligence, hypersonics, synthetic biology, sourcing of rare earth minerals and semiconductors, quantum computing, 5G and 6G communication networks, and energy and climate innovations. As a tech sector pioneer who co-founded Ariba and led DocuSign's growth and IPO, he was the youngest ever vice president in the history of General Motors and the highest ranking U.S. diplomat to visit Taiwan since the United States recognized a communist government in Beijing. He has quite the story to tell, and he's one of the few high-ranking individuals that was in the Trump administration that continued to have an important advisory role in the Biden administration, helping ensure policy continuity with respect to China and U.S. leadership in tech diplomacy. So we spoke about Keith's origin story. We spoke about his humble beginnings in Ohio. He worked in industry. He worked for his dad's business. And he was obsessed with technology and innovation and disruption, which obviously translated into all the incredible companies he worked for and grew and eventually exited. Of course, being CEO of Ariba and DocuSign, as well as all the other things that he's done, is no small feat. But over the course of his career, he noticed that innovation and disruption, if you play fair, that's great, but you understand that there's other players in the world that don't play fair, that don't have that same ethical and moral compass that always guided the companies that Keith built. So he decided to take a stand against it. He understood the problem, and he worked with the U.S. government as Undersecretary of State to create a trust principle, which fought back against techno-authoritarianism. I'm going to tell you exactly what that is, and so will he, and also how it really impacts the U.S. and the battle that he won over 5G with China, the levers that he pulled in order to make sure that China does not dominate the U.S. when it comes to technical innovation. And he did that through a variety of means, but a lot of it was based on galvanizing countries that had the same moral compass as the U.S. and focusing on the things that differentiate the U.S. and make it the greatest country in the world, which is democracy. Then we spoke about the lessons that he learned actually combating China, 5G. They won that battle. And then the things that we have to look out for in the future, the risks that are very real to the U.S. We speak about all the things that he has done as Undersecretary of State. We speak about the trust principle. We speak about the Clean Network Alliance of Democracies. We speak about why companies have to have a China plan, similar to when companies pulled out of Russia because of Russia attacking Ukraine. Do you have a China plan for your business? And lastly, what is technical statecraft and why do we have to worry about it? And this is something that he's very focused on right now. So let's jump right into it. This is Keith Kroc, former U.S. Undersecretary of State, as well as CEO of DocuSign and Ariba.
Well, my father had a five-person machine shop in the good times. It was just me and him in the tough times. I was welding at age 12. The customers were, the big three auto companies. And I learned so much from that experience. My dad had a great sense of humor. You know, he'd answer the phone. Litco Industries, Steel Fabrication Division, John Kroc speaking, Director of Sales, how may I help you? And I would go, hey, Dad, there's only three of us in here. He goes, that's right. Our customers are the big three, and, we specialize in quality service. Don't let them come to the factory. It was a great experience. And, he wanted me to go off and get some college knowledge and become an engineer so I could grow the machine shop to a big company. Maybe 10 people. And, although I didn't go back, I think he was proud that, I went to Purdue and studied engineering and General Motors gave me a fellowship there and also then to business school. And then I ended up going to General Motors. As a matter of fact, that fellowship in business school, they paid me a half salary. So when I graduated, I actually bought my dad for the first time a new car. I bought him a Delta 88 diesel, General Motors car way back then.
When did you first get fascinated, interested in technology? When did you, because you're working in industry at a young age, and you've been in like every single industry possible that has been transformed over the past, 20, 30 years. So robotics, engineering, commerce, education, diplomacy, philanthropy, like everything you touch seems to be like you're always at the right spot, right time. So what was that catalyst? What was that first thing you did that made you understand that you had an exceptional ability to disrupt, to innovate, to influence? And I think if you look at your incredible career, that's kind of that's that point in your life led to so much more. And I want to understand what that point was.
Yeah, I think it probably started in the factory because, I love working on the machines. And then when I went off to General Motors, my first job at age 19 was as a production foreman, second shift chassis line for Cadillac. And it was the only Cadillac plant in the world. We had 15,000 employees. So I was fascinated with automation. And then my second year at Harvard Business School, I wrote, this is kind of like a mini thesis on utilization of robotics in the Japanese auto industry. And so when I came out of business school, they said, hey, because I'd also work in the New York Treasurer's office, and they said, hey, what are you interested in? I go, robots. And they said, well, we have a super secret robot project, the most sophisticated robot in the world at the General Motors Research Labs. And back then, GM was the biggest company in the world, 1.5 million employees. And they said, we don't know what we're going to do with it. We don't know what we'd have you do. I go, that sounds perfect. And so next thing you know, I'm presenting to the board of directors at age 24 that General Motors should get in the robotics business. And to my surprise, they said, okay, let's do it. How should we do it? And I'm like, can I come back at the next board meeting? it was kind of funny. And I had worked, in the New York Church office, that's the staff for the board of directors. I had worked for a guy named Rick Wagner, who ended up being the CEO and chairman for like 10 years. And so I came back and I said, well, we need a much broader product line. So we need to joint venture with somebody. And they go, okay, yeah, that's a good idea. With who? I go, can I come back in a month? And I came back And now understand that the board back then, they were all World War II veterans. I said, we should do the joint venture. We should partner with Fujitsu Fanuc. And they go, you mean the Japanese? I go, yes, the Japanese. And it was a brilliant operation. To this day, it's the largest manufacturer of industrial robots in the world. And at that, and we put GE, IBM, and Westinghouse out of business. We became the industry leader by a factor of four. The average age of our team back then was, I don't know, probably mid-30s. I was 26 when I became the VP of it. And it was a great experience. And that really got me going on technology. And then we were selling a lot of robots in Silicon Valley in the disk drive business. And I was fascinated by that. And that's why on my 30th birthday, I left General Motors, which was unheard of in those days. People thought I was nuts, to head on out to the West Point of capitalism, you know, the United Nations, you know, of business, and in the ultimate meritocracy with a premium on youth.
I know a lot of entrepreneurs listen to this show, and NetSuite has been a huge supporter for entrepreneurs, for business owners, because there's one thing that we all know. Business is about making money, and it's about your bottom line. And the less you spend on the nuts and bolts of running your business, the more profits you keep. But these days, everything is costing more. Supplies, people, shipping. It squeezes your margins, and I've been there, juggling multiple systems for finance, inventory, you name it. Each with its own costs and its own set of headaches. That's why I made the switch to NetSuite by Oracle. It's changed our company. Think about it. NetSuite is one of the top financial systems out there. It puts your whole business on one platform, accounting, finance, the works. One data source for everyone. There's no more mismatched info. And because it's in the cloud, it slashes your IT costs. No more servers, no more updates. Just access NetSuite from anywhere. With one integrated suite, your overhead drops big time. And here's the real win. Efficiency. Everything's connected in NetSuite. Costs are ridiculous lately. Find a proven way to reduce your expenses and get better performance out of your team. It's a no-brainer, and that's what NetSuite offers. Over 37,000 companies have figured this out already. You have to join them. Right now, through to April 15th, NetSuite's got an incredible, flexible financing plan. Check it out and see the savings yourself at netsuite.com/ScottClary. That's netsuite.com/ScottClary. Hiring as a small business owner is a major pain. That's why LinkedIn is supporting today's episode. You need people with the right skills and experience, but finding them can take forever. It is incredibly frustrating to keep seeing candidates who just aren't a good fit, and that's why LinkedIn Jobs has been a game changer. Let me tell you a little story. We needed to hire a graphic designer, somebody with specific tech and software knowledge and the ability to truly understand our brand. And I started with all the usual job boards, and it's the same old story. Tons of irrelevant applications. No one's really matching my needs. I tried LinkedIn Jobs, and the quality of candidates was just on another level. People with impressive portfolios, relevant expertise. I finally felt like I was interviewing the right people. That's truly the power of LinkedIn's massive professional network. You're tapping into this huge pool of talent you simply wouldn't find on other sites. It's about finding those niche candidates you actually need. And with the right people in front of you, hiring becomes a breeze. Did you know that 86% of small businesses find a qualified candidate on LinkedIn Jobs within 24 hours? That is how well their system works. Honestly, do yourself a favor and try LinkedIn Jobs next time you're hiring. You can post your job for free at linkedin.com/excellence. That's linkedin.com/excellence. Terms and conditions apply, but it's definitely worth trying out. I don't know about you, but the idea of being harassed, scammed, or even worse, all because somebody found my personal information online, that's terrifying. Our political opinions, our addresses, even stuff about our families, it's out there for anyone to grab. And did you know that data brokers are allowed to sell information on over 98% of Americans? It's scary stuff. That's why I've partnered with Delete Me. I personally use Delete Me. They're a big friend of the podcast because I put myself out there online. So safety is a huge concern. It's really scary how easy it is to find someone's details and information, but Delete Me creates a layer of protection that we all need. You tell Delete Me what you want gone, and they make it disappear from those sketchy data broker sites. And Delete Me doesn't stop. They constantly monitor the web to keep your information off those lists. It's like having a privacy watchdog that never sleeps. You need to take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me. They're giving a special discount for all Success Story podcast listeners. Get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com. joinmarketplace.com/success and use promo code success at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/success and enter code success at checkout. joindeleteme.com/success. Hey everyone, I just want to take a second and thank the sponsor of today's episode, Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond Bourbon. Now, I don't have a lot of liquor sponsors on this show. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond is actually one of my favorites. I've drank it for a few years now, and this is why we actually decided to work together. Heaven Hill Distillery, family owned since 1935, is a great entrepreneur story too. So there's five brothers. They filled their first whiskey barrels back in 1935, and their legacy still lives on today. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond is aged over 7 years. That's three more than required by the Bottled and Bond Act of 1897. This means the best quality, the best purity, and the best consistency. This is not just average bourbon. It's the winner of the double gold medals at multiple 2023 World Spirits competitions, and they've won the very prestigious Triple Still Award. It's a very big deal in the liquor and bourbon world. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond boasts an exceptionally smooth oak flavor, while its aroma offers a sweet blend of caramel and smooth vanilla. If you love bourbon, you need to try Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond. Available nationally, look for a bottle at your local store. Heaven Hill reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely. Think back to your last few days in the office. Did any of them leave you feeling really accomplished? Not the kind of day where you're running around like crazy, but where you've made real progress on something that matters. Because being busy doesn't always mean being productive, and I bet you we've all been there, and maybe it's time to rethink what it means to get things done. Today's episode is sponsored by Belay. And what they help you do is, instead of getting sucked into emails and to-do lists, they help you delegate tasks and focus on big goals. They can connect you with top-notch US-based talent who are ready to take on those time-consuming tasks that bog you down. Let's be real. There are way more important things you could be doing than bookkeeping or wrangling a packed inbox. They have virtual assistants to handle all of those pesky administrative tasks or accounting professional to take care of all your financials. But here's the best part. You don't have to waste weeks searching for the right person. Belay's personalized matching service works quickly, sometimes matching you with the right talent to take stuff off your plate in under a week. Are you ready to try a different way of working? Check out Belay's list of the top 25 things you can delegate to a virtual assistant. It might just change your business and your life. Text SUCCESS, that's SUCCESS, to 55123 to get the list and to start transforming your to-do list with Belay.
Headed out to Silicon Valley.
And when you look back at some of the problems that you've tried to solve, and I actually mentioned like a few industries, and I incorrectly didn't even cover the full scope of all the things that you've worked on. When you look at like the next problem you want to solve, you are a disruptor. You look at an industry and you look like 10 years, 15 years ahead, and that's probably how you've achieved most of your success. And that's thinking different, and you were wired that way from a very young age. So when you go into a variety of different industries and categories, we don't have to go into all of them because there's been a lot, but how do you look at an industry? How do you pinpoint? Because the serial entrepreneurship across multiple categories, that's incredible. The very few people achieve. You see people that go into the same categories again and again, but you've done it in so many different industries. What's that secret? What's that lens that you look at the business through?
Well, in a phrase, I would say it'd be challenge the status quo. I would also say it would be look for a technology paradigm shift. So for example, the one after General Motors was in engineering design software. And back then, they had just come out with a thing called workstations that had the power of a mainframe. So you could do all kinds of things with that. And we developed this new technology called mechanical design synthesis, where you could optimize designs. You could literally press a button and it would redraw it for you. And it's, you know, my oldest son who works at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratories utilized that technology. You know, and for example, when we started this company called Ariba, where we invented business-to-business electronic commerce, this was back in 95, and the internet had just come out. So it was the first enterprise application written on the internet. So it's always kind of on the cutting edge. You know, DocuSign was cloud computing and mobile had just really come into its own. Because when there's a paradigm shift, what that means is all the old legacy players go back to kind of ground zero so you can disrupt them, so you can challenge that status quo. So that's, you know, I think that's been the key. But at the end of the day, you know, the number one job of a CEO is to build a high-performance team. And I really believe the company with the best people wins. The key is getting them working together as a team. And especially the key is to have different temperaments, talents, and convictions, because that diversity of thought is the catalyst for genius.
I love that. And as you, you know, you go through your career, you've had multiple successes, taken multiple companies public. The concept of tech diplomacy, which is now what you're focused on mostly, how did your career in private industry, in public industry, in government, how did that inform and help you understand that this was something that you wanted to take on at this point in your life? And I want you also to describe what tech diplomacy is, because candidly, there's a lot of subjects that I speak about on this podcast, and tech diplomacy, I've actually never heard it before I, you know, started researching for our show, and we were, you know, trying to do the research and figure out what exactly this is and why is it relevant and what does it mean for the average person. So let's understand where this passion for tech diplomacy came from, because it's highly relevant now, and what is it and why are you working in it?
Sure. So where it really came about was when I was running DocuSign. And we were up to about 500 million unique users around the world. We had entered every major country except for China. And I went on a two-week listening trip. I usually would do that if we were going to a big country. And I've been going there since 1981. I mean, I'm a lover of Chinese history, culture, the people, of course, the food. But this time, it was different. I could see that their traditional market competition was amped up into a new form of techno-economic aggression under General Secretary Xi. You know, I had a chance to see their drone swarm technology. I learned about the One Belt, One Road initiative, which is looked like a military supply chain to me. They were telling me to download Tencent every 30 minutes. I met with five of the top seven Politburo members. And as I was getting back on that plane, I'm like going, you know, the guys with the best technology win the war. These guys don't seem like good guys to me. And I go, I wonder if the guys in Washington know about this. And I didn't know really anybody in Washington or in the administration. So a week later, I went out there. I made it my mission to do that. Next thing you know, I'm in a room and explain about China, and they go, have you ever thought about serving your country, Keith? And I go, well, that's a dream I never knew I had. I'd be honored. And they go, can you move? I go, I can move anywhere in the world. It's the fastest decision I ever made in my life. So that's when they sent me to the State Department to run U.S. economic diplomacy. And my mission there was to develop and operationalize a global economic security strategy that drives economic growth, maximizes national security, and combats economic aggression. And so one of the first things that I did, as always, is I brought in a great team. It was kind of unheard of in the State Department. I brought in 12 folks from Silicon Valley, results-oriented execs, entrepreneurs, technologists, and we combined it with the greatest foreign service officers and civil servants like imaginable, and it ended up to be just a dynamite team. And so tech diplomacy, what that does is that combines Silicon Valley strategies with foreign policy tools based on a thing called the Trust Principle, which was a doctrine we created to defeat China's master plan to control 5G communications.
I just want to take a second and thank the sponsor of today's episode, HubSpot. Now, if you're growing a business, you've got a ton on your plate. You need more leads. You need to close deals faster. You need to get better insights to connect with your customers. You need a CRM, one that works from day one, gives your teams a central source of truth, and helps them do more faster. That's why you need HubSpot. HubSpot is an all-in-one CRM platform that will accelerate your business growth without slowing down efficiency. With thousands of customizable tools like ad tracking, social media management, and an AI content assistant, your teams will have everything they need to convert prospects to qualified leads. Plus, you can customize your CRM with apps and integrations that meet the needs of your business at any stage. So as your business grows, HubSpot CRM grows with you. Get started for free today at HubSpot.com. It's incredible what you did, because everything that you just said that you did is something that I speak about in regards to the issue with government, is that they don't move quick enough. They don't have outside thought coming in. So you effectively brought in some of the top talent in Silicon Valley. You applied that to an actual administration, and you brought them in, and now you're actually solving problems at the speed and with the lens that a Silicon Valley exec would look at a problem versus a career politician. So that's something that can actually make incredible moves. Now, when you go down this pathway, you move from private, you were and public, and you move from that into government. Talk about the current state of China, of what they have under their control, what they're trying to do. How does that impact us? Yeah. For example, even if I think about foreign investment into startups in the U.S., what do we have to be wary of? How do we fight back against that?
Sure, sure. You know, I kind of had a chance to see it my whole life because, what I could see through the years, through my dad's company back, in Ohio in the Midwest, I could see that China's weapons of mass production had devastated the heart of our economic engine. That's, small and medium-sized manufacturers. When I was a vice president of General Motors, I could see if you built a plant in China, you weren't just giving them the blueprints. You were giving them the process engineering, how to build it, and also training their people so they could come back and compete against you. I also, when I was at Ariba, we had our intellectual property stolen from Alibaba. And now what we see, the reality we face as a nation and as a free world, is seemingly ceaseless, intense variation of weaponized economic competition, because our rivals are playing the long game. They're playing for keeps. They're playing a four-dimensional game of military, economic, diplomatic, and cultural chess. And at the intersection point and the primary battleground is technology. And worst of all, these authoritarian regimes have no respect whatsoever for rule of law, for property of all kinds, for sovereignty of nations, for human rights, for the environment, for the press. And, we have to raise our game. And there is nothing static about superpower advantage. And so the world needs American leadership. So that's what, this was all about. And when I had my Senate confirmation hearing, I had the good fortune, the rare fortune of being unanimously confirmed, was I got asked by Senator Coons, and he said, Keith, what would your strategy be to combat China's economic aggression? And I said, I would harness U.S.'s three biggest areas of competitive advantage, by rallying and unifying our allies and our friends, by leveraging the innovation and the resources of the private sector, and by amplifying the moral high ground of democratic values. And that turned out to be an enduring model now that is used in the Biden administration to combat that aggression. And it was that strategy, combined with that trust principle, that enabled us to defeat that master plan for 5G. We also used it to create a thing called the Blue Dot Network, which is an equitable and unifying alternative to what China has called the One Belt, One Road, or as a Malaysian finance minister called it, the One Belt, One Way Toll Road to Beijing. This is where China goes all over the world and creates these debt traps with these low-income nations, takes advantage, build their infrastructure, puts their, devastates the environment. They also really take advantage of the people in that country. They don't leave them with any skills, and they leave them strapped for cash. So we also used it in strengthening U.S.-Taiwan ties. So I was the highest State Department official to visit Taiwan in 41 years. I was greeted with 40 fighters and bombers. And we used that trust principle to put together a thing called the Economic Prosperity Partnership and a number of other things. Also used that to call out the human rights abuses against the Uyghur Muslims in a western part of China called Xinjiang. And on July 4th, 2020, on national TV, I called out that genocide. I was the first government official to do that. And so that trust principle was really the basis of everything.
And why was the, you know, I think it's because you've dealt with and observed China for so long, and maybe that's the answer, but why were these particular causes so important to you? Because there's a lot of other things that threaten the U.S. in terms of their economic prowess, and there's other countries. Obviously, China is one of them, and we look at Russia as well, and I'm sure there's a few others that probably are trying to compete on various levels, but the things that you deployed in Taiwan in particular, why does that tie back to the impact that, you know, China could have on the U.S.? Because I think Taiwan's in a precarious position right now.
By the way, Taiwan is a linchpin for democracy and a role model of freedom. That's what they are to the free world. Now, to General Secretary Xi, what they are is they dispel his myth that the Chinese culture cannot live under a democracy, but it has to live under authoritarian rule, and he wants it gone. And by the way, to companies around the world, China-U.S. conflict would be devastating and literally catastrophic for the high-tech business, because in Taiwan, that's where they manufacture the most sophisticated semiconductors in the world, which is the foundation for all technology. So this is really a big deal. And if you think of China is the biggest threat to freedom and democracy around the world. And you know, it was interesting. When I was undersecretary, and this was in January 2020, I came back from Washington to my home in San Francisco. I hosted 36 of the top CEOs in Silicon Valley. You'd recognize all their names, all the companies. Many of them been here before. It was a safe environment. And I asked them to go around the room and tell their China horror stories. And, you know, I can't talk about the contents of that meeting, but I can tell you this, is that it was cathartic, it was enlightening, and it was frightening all at once, Scott. And at the end of it, I said, you know, guys, we say out here that corporate responsibility is social responsibility. It's also national security. It's global economic security, too, because not only is China a real and urgent threat to our democracy and our freedom, but they're also a real and urgent threat to our businesses. And so if you think of the things, Scott, that we honor, those things like respect for rule of law and property and the environment and human rights, these are things that we honor, and authoritarian regimes like Russia and China do not. And they, as a matter of fact, they use it against them for their strategic advantage. So think about this, Scott. So let's say you're a Silicon Valley CEO, and I'm a Chinese company. So if I could steal your intellectual property, if I don't have to be transparent, if I can use slave labor, if I can use cheap, huge energy, coal-fired power plants, if I don't have to be reciprocal with my market, if I either am the law or I don't have to obey the law, I'm going to beat you every time. Mm-hmm. And so, and they use co-option, coercion, all this stuff. No respect for human life. That's what we call the power principle. So what we did is we created this doctrine called the trust principle, where we actually used it to our advantage. So one jujitsu move, we flipped them on their back. So we actually weaponized the very principles that protect our freedom.
So I'm super curious, because you were successful in the campaign when they were trying to basically control 5G. So if you wanted to deploy this strategy against future tech, because obviously this is going to be a recurring thing, it's not like a one and done. How do you actually, because all the things you mentioned before are great and they're nice and they're high level, but tactically that you're allowed to talk about, how do you actually deploy this principle to safeguard, to protect the U.S.? What are the levers that you pull?
Yeah. So, by the way, it applies across all areas of technology and all areas of economic competition, maybe even some military areas. So what was going on with 5G, because it's a great case study. And by the way, we extended it to cloud computing. Mm-hmm. We extended it to applications. We extended it to underwater cable. It can be applied to clean currency. It can be applied to electric vehicles, all of that. So this was back in early 2020. So China had a master plan to control 5G, and 5G is way more than a cell phone. The speeds are so fast that it can control power grids, utility systems, sanitation systems, manufacturing processes, Internet of Things. It carries people's most personal data, government's most precious secrets. And it looked like their national champion, Huawei, who's the backbone for their most important company and their backbone for their surveillance state enabler genocide, was going to run the table. They had just announced 97 5G deals, 47 of them in Europe, and U.S. efforts were failing. And we got the authorities within the government to go make a last-ditch effort. And the reason why the previous efforts were failing, so predecessors were going around different countries banging on a table saying, don't buy Huawei. So us guys from the private sector, we said, hey, why don't we just treat them, these other countries and these telcos like customers, and the customer's always right. And we need a value. Nobody likes to be told what to do. And we need a value proposition so that they'll partner with us. And that was key. The other thing too, the biggest key comes back to this issue. It wasn't a technology issue at all, Scott. It was about trust. And in my first 60 bilaterals as Undersecretary of State, where I meet with foreign ministers, finance ministers, economic ministers, I'd be in a meeting, I'd say, hey, how's your relationship with China? They would say, well, they're an important trading partner. They're number one, number two. And then they kind of look both ways, like somebody's in a room, they lean, they go, but we don't trust them. And that rang bells in my head, because just the year before, I'm standing up in front of all the DocuSign employees go, we're not in the software business. We are in the trust business. We deal with people's most important documents. Those are the ones you sign. Mm-hmm. And trust is the basis of every relationship, personal, business, or otherwise. You do business with people you trust. You partner with people you trust. You buy from people you trust. You love people you trust. And boy, 5G is the trust business. So we go around to these companies, these telcos, we would say, who are you going to trust with your citizens' personal data? Who are you going to trust with your company's proprietary technology? Who are you going to trust with your government's most precious secrets? And that was what we deployed. And it really was a successful strategy. Now, we did a lot of things that were non-traditional in government. An example was we called on foreign company CEOs because we knew so many of them. We were calling on the telcos, like Deutsche Telekom, or there's one in Australia, Telstra. These are the AT&Ts of these different companies, NTT, to get them on our side. By the time we were done, in less than a year, we had 60 countries representing over two-thirds of the world's global GDP, at 200 telcos, and a host of industry-leading companies on this clean network And this is what defeated him. And in that process, we exposed their biggest weakness, which is lack of trust. Nobody trusts these guys. And that was the key. That was the key strategic positioning. And this ended up being the first government-led initiative that actually defeated China Inc. and now has turned into this bipartisan model that has bridged from a Republican administration to a Democratic administration. And, you know, when you look at what's going on in Ukraine right now, those courageous Ukrainians, the heartbreaking atrocities that Putin's commit, this is what we need more than ever, is this alliance of democracies. Because if you look at these authoritarians, and Xi in particular, what is his strategy? His strategy is to divide and conquer and pick off the weak gazelle from the herd. And you couldn't even believe how intimidated that countries and companies are of China, because they have a formula of intimidation, retaliation, retribution. So what the clean network provided was a security blanket, because there's strength in numbers and there's power in unity and solidarity.
Do you feel like the fact that you deployed this and now you have the clean network and there's a model that we can work off of, do you feel like countries, private companies, are going to feel safer collaborating on similar things in the future? Do you think we've sort of seen a paradigm shift in galvanizing people?
And by the way, absolutely, because they could see how powerful it was. And the need, and by the way, you can see what's going on over in Europe. You can see, these democracies rallying, because these authoritarian regimes, these are guys that care only about two things. One is regime preservation, mm-hmm. and the other is domination. And they have no regard for human life. And, you know, one of my other responsibilities at the State Department was infectious diseases. And I can tell you, in terms of the pandemic, all roads lead to Wuhan, and the emperor has no clothes. And these guys covered this thing up so bad. I mean, they destroyed all the original samples, a lot of the data, killed people, rolled out their propaganda machine. And it's, it is one of the biggest crimes ever committed in the world.
What's up, everyone? Just want to take a second, thank the sponsor of today's episode, Brevo. Now, Brevo is a game-changing platform that has the potential to supercharge your business. If you want to expand your customer base, supercharge your revenue, who doesn't, right? Brevo is the go-to platform. Brevo, you used to know it as SendinBlue, is designed to fully empower businesses to thrive. With Brevo, you have all the tools you need in one easy-to-use platform to cultivate meaningful relationships and drive sustainable, predictable growth. Brevo makes it simple and accessible to create engaging, personalized email campaigns, SMS or WhatsApp messages, stunning landing pages, automated workflows. Whether your goal is customer acquisition, retention, loyalty, Brevo checks all the boxes. It has a toolkit you need to turn the one-time browser into the long-time customer. Beyond just marketing, Brevo is a unified platform. It allows you to streamline your business ops, scheduling meetings, managing tasks and projects, all in one place. It's an ideal growth tool for marketers, SMBs, and sales teams looking for one consolidated toolbox to scale their business. It's trusted by over 500,000 businesses across 180 countries. It includes leaders like Sodexo, Louis Vuitton, Carrefour, eBay, Michelin. They all rely on Brevo's robust technology and extensive integrations to deliver unparalleled customer experiences, reduce costs, drive sales. This is what you got to do. Get started with Brevo for free by clicking our link below or going to brevo.com/success and use the promo code success to save 50% on your first 3 months of the starter and business plan. That's brevo.com/success, promo code success, and sign up for free. When you look at when you look at what's happening in Ukraine right now, obviously this is horrendous. There's atrocities being committed by Russia, by Putin. How could we deploy some of these strategies in the future with even non-NATO countries? What is the thing that, if you were looking at this situation, like, what do you wish we could have done to sort of, without bringing them into NATO even, try and fix some of these problems before they manifest? Because now you see other nations are very scared of what's happening in Ukraine.
Yeah. You know, as a matter of fact, I think it gets back to those three key principles of unifying and rallying our allies and leveraging the innovation of mm-hmm. the private sector and amplifying those moral high grounds. I just wrote a piece. It came out in Fortune today that is called Present Your China Plan at the Next Board Meeting. Because here, and this is all about the private sector. So if you think about what happened in Ukraine, in Russia, there's over 300 big companies that pulled out their operations out of Russia because of Ukraine. And this is an expensive proposition, caught everybody off guard. Nobody had a plan. And so what I'm seeing now in the boardrooms with the the most respected board members around the world are asking from their CEO, what's your China contingency plan if there's a U.S.-China conflict or a U.S. or a China-Taiwan conflict? Because now that probability has gone up, and she is obsessed with taking over Taiwan. Because, hey, when it happens, it's too late. So don't get caught off guard again. And you should have that plan there sitting on that shelf. As a matter of fact, the CEO should begin to implement it immediately. So that's one of the really, really big things.
It's interesting. Expensive problem to solve, but very interesting.
Yeah. And you know, China's economy is 10 times what Russia is. Yeah. So, and there's a lot of entanglement there. So that's a key thing. And, you know, I've sat on a lot of boards. And, you know, the number one responsibility of a board member, in addition to hiring and firing a CEO, is you have to mitigate risk. And you have a plan sitting on the shelf for, like, the one that keeps everybody up at night. That's a cyber breach. By the way, you need a plan sitting on a shelf for this China contingency plan, because Xi is not slowing down. As a matter of fact, he is just speeding up. And it looks like he's going to be elected for life. So he's going to be unencumbered.
When you look forward to the future, what are the tactics you think China could deploy that keep you up at night? What are the different things that you think they will go after now, knowing that you have a plan to sort of counterattack what they've been doing in the U.S. and with 5G and any other technology that develops? Like, the only thing that I think of, and maybe you can provide commentary on this or other, would they try and find, for example, startups that maybe are a little bit hungrier, are a little bit more, they need help more than a large Fortune 500 private company or public company. Maybe they go after people at an earlier stage when they really need that capital, and then they sort of plant that seed there. Is that real, or is that, or other things that we have to watch for?
Scott, they've been doing that for years. That's kind of a standard operating procedure, is to get guys early on who need that financial capital so they could take control of the company, particularly here in Silicon Valley. And by the way, they disguise a lot of these companies. These guys are masters of concealment and deception. You know, what a lot of people don't understand is the average American investor and pensioner is financing China's military buildup, their surveillance state, enabling their genocide. And the way China does that, you think of all these Chinese companies, you know, they're involved in this. They've broken into an unnatural amount. You never see it in the real world of subsidiaries with different names in the Cayman Islands, and that's for the purpose of concealment and deception. Then what they do is they seduce with money these index funds, like MSCI index funds, FTSE index funds, where they're able to bury their companies, whether they're on a Chinese stock exchange or even in the U.S. stock exchange. And then those go into these big funds, like BlackRock is the biggest. There are 431 emerging market funds. These are like ETFs and mutual funds. And then those get buried in the $11.7 trillion pension funds in the U.S. So one of the big things that we need to do is stop financing China's malign activities. Because, see, they need hard currency over there. So that's a really, really a big one. And that's something a lot of people don't realize. You know, my last press conference as undersecretary, you know, I asked the press, I said, you know, send a message to the average American investor to ask their financial manager, whoever manages their pension, to tell them what Chinese companies are in their funds. And if they say they don't know, then ask them to find out. And if they come back and they don't give you the answer, or if they don't come back, best find a new fund manager. And this is something that, you know, I wrote to a letter to all university governing boards, because it's also in all these university endowment funds. This is big monies in there. I wrote a letter to all United States CEOs and boards about utilizing slave labor and financing the Chinese, intellectual property theft and all that. Because, you know, when I think back when I was a CEO, or when I was also I was chairman of the board of trustees at Purdue, I didn't know any of this stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it's time to turn that tide, because, you know, what we thought, Scott, for the longest time, we thought capitalism equals democracy. China proved us wrong on that. And it's time to take off the rose-colored glasses and treat them not how we hope they'd be, but how they truly are.
Talk to me about you co-founded at Purdue the Institute for Tech Diplomacy. So I feel like that's in the same vein as what we were just speaking about. So what's the goal with this?
Yeah.
What are you trying to accomplish? What's it teaching over?
Well, Scott, technology must advance freedom. Technology is powerful, getting more powerful every day. It could be used for good or bad purposes. So that, you know, that mission is to advance technology, or to advance freedom through trusted technology, by utilizing the trust principle, and also by training diplomats around the world, training the private sector in tech statecraft. How do you compete against somebody who doesn't play by the rules, mm-hmm. and wants to put you out of business? So that's what it's about. And it's now become probably the world's preeminent authority in this whole area of tech diplomacy and tech statecraft and building trusted networks. And it's totally bipartisan. For example, we have former Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta is on the board. We have the longest-serving director of NASA is on the board. We just put on the number two guy at NATO, Deputy Secretary Giuliani. So this is an international effort, and really against probably the biggest existential threat that democracy faces, and it's real, because, you know, this democracy we have is just an experiment,
mm-hmm.
and you know, growing up in that little house in Ohio with a white picket fence and a dog and 2.5 children, that's kind of goes against all the laws of physics. It's an unnatural act, because, you know, the most natural order of things is the bad king, the dictator, and the emperor, and you got to fight every day for that. I clearly learned that in my service to the country.
Yeah, no, I appreciate what you're doing, And hopefully, and I'm sure this is, I'll ask this question in a second, but I also want to know like what your plans are for the future after your incredible career and where you want to take it from here, because this is like you're building up the blueprint again in another category that's just being developed. So, you know, you're leading the way. But before I ask that question, it'd be silly of me not to just commend you. You were nominated for the 2022 Nobel Peace Prize. Walk me through even what that feels like to be part of that. Did you expect any of this? Was this something that you've ever even dreamed that would happen? Or is this something that, you know, it's just a byproduct of somebody who's committed their whole life to trying to do the right thing?
Well, Scott, it was a shock, first of all, but the lasting feeling is humbling, because you look at the Nobel Peace Prize award winners in the past, whether it's guys like Nelson Mandela or Mother Teresa, I mean, Martin Luther King, that list goes on. But also, you know, I think of, for example, what's going on in Ukraine and the courage of those Ukrainians. You know, it's hard to compare. And, you know, the other thing, when something like this happens, it's really about the team. And I had a fabulous bipartisan, diverse team that really made that happen. So, you know, it was a surprise for me. It's obviously a great honor. You know, I'll never forget, it is kind of funny, is that so when my father and I, we were working in that factory, you know, when I was a teenager, we'd go in on Saturdays and we'd clean out the bathrooms together. And I remember once we're scrubbing out the toilets and all of a sudden I hear him just yell, because I hated it, you know, he hated it too. And I hear him yell, "Keith, we can't solve world peace, but we can try." You know, I mean, it's just funny. Anyway, I wish he was alive right now. Here's another funny story. The only person that wasn't surprised was my 95-year-old mom. So I have her on a Zoom call, right? And my two sisters are by. I go, "Hey, Ma, I've been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize." She goes, "Oh, I knew you would. I knew you always would be. Of course, yes." mother.
She's a good mom. I mean, she's a good mom.
You've been planning this since I was 1 year old. I wish you would have told me, Mom.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, she was the same person when I would be playing football on Friday nights, and she would go, "Keith, kill him!" You know, and we'd be in a huddle. They go, "Croc, is that your Ma?" I go, "Yeah." "Will you tell her to shut the heck up?" I go, "I'm not telling her to shut the heck up. You guys tell her." I go, "We're not telling her." I go, "Run to play. Let's go. Ready, break."
That's beautiful. It's good she's around for this. That's very beautiful. I want to do a couple of rapid fire to close this out. But most importantly, before I pivot to those, where can people connect with you? Where do you want to send people? The websites, the social, anything you're working on, what are the places you want people to go see?
Yeah, so I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Twitter. There's a KeithCroc.com website. Then, of course, visit our website at the Kroc Institute for Tech Diplomacy. That's techdiplomacy.org, I think.
So I'll get it in the show notes. I'll get it all in the show notes.
Yeah.
Perfect. Okay. So let's do a couple rapid fire. So I alluded to this question before, but it's a great question because, again, you've accomplished so much. Like serial CEO, entrepreneur, now underwriter, and now Nobel undersecretary, a Nobel Peace Prize nominee. What do you want to accomplish next? What's your goal? When, you know, in the next 200 years, when somebody speaks your name, what do you want them to associate with what you've accomplished?
Well, I've been jumping in water over my head my whole life, and it creates an adrenaline rush. And after a while, that adrenaline rush is addicting. So, you know, I think that's maybe the first sign of a serial transformational leader. I mean, I can't join an organization that I don't try to transform. So what's next? I'm not really sure, but the next thing usually comes. But I can tell you, if you ask me what I like to do the most, I have a wonderful family. I have five children. There's nothing I like more than that, and transforming their lives, and a wonderful wife whose name is Meta, who I've affectionately now just call Facebook. But, she's funny. But if you ask me, you know, Croc, what do you think your legacy will be? I don't think it will be, to me, it's not the companies I built or even the causes. I think it's the people that I've mentored along the way. And I've benefited great from mentors my whole life. You know, my mom always used to say the best way to learn is OPE, other people's experience. Because she said, learn from other people's mistakes, because you learn the most when you make mistakes. You'll have time enough to make your own.
And, good advice.
And I also started an organization called the Global Mentor Network, which mentors the transformational leaders of tomorrow at scale with some of the greatest transformational leaders. By the way, that's a great website to send your audience to. It's called the Global Mentor Network. My dad used to say, you never know if you're a good father until you see your children's children. I also think you never know if you're a great, great leader until you see your mentees, because the ultimate is to pay it forward and pass it down. And by the way, that's the secret to Silicon Valley, is the genealogy and the mentorship, because all this stuff is not written in a book. And so anyway, I think my legacy would be the people that I've mentored, through the years. And they're, like your great-grandchildren kind of thing. That's the best way to leave a legacy. I love that.
Hey, Success Story listeners, Scott here. Just want to give a shout out to the sponsor of today's episode, the eBay for Business podcast. This is a resource that every entrepreneur should be tapping into. I don't take this lightly. I'm a podcaster. I have a high level of scrutiny for the other podcasts that I tell people to go check out. But this is a good one. Whether you're starting out or you're looking to grow your existing business, this podcast is your golden ticket. It's packed full of insider knowledge on how to start, run, scale a business on eBay with firsthand insights from eBay employees on product launches and campaigns. But it's not just about eBay. It dives into external factors affecting your business, like tax reporting, marketing, sales, all the stuff that you're going to have to figure out to sell stuff on eBay effectively, build a business on eBay effectively. What sets it apart? They bring on eBay executives and successful sellers who've been there, done that, and are eager to share their experiences, advice, and tips. If you have a burning question, their Q&A sessions tackle seller-submitted inquiries, all types of questions, so you're always in the loop. So this is what you got to do. Don't miss out on this go-to source for all things eBay. Tune in to the eBay for Business podcast weekly, wherever you get your podcasts. It's time to take your business to the next level with insights from those who've already done it.
What keeps you up at night now?
If you ask me that as a CEO, I'd always say, well, it's that cyber breach, yeah. Right? DocuSign is the most hacked application in the world now. By the way, it's the authoritarian. I mean, it's the Russians and the Chinese, because Xi and Putin are not going to stop. Because if they do, they're dead. And these guys have obviously nuclear weapons at their disposal. Xi is too smart to do a 9/11 or a Pearl Harbor. So it's kind of like a python, just keep wrapping around. So most important thing is, can the world wake up soon enough? What was interesting for me is we were going around building the clean network a year ago during the height of COVID. I could see citizens of the world waking up to what I call China's 3 C's doctrine of concealment, co-option, coercion, because these citizens now understand that the pandemic is a result of the concealment of the virus, whether you believe it came from the Wuhan lab or not. And they could also see the co-option of Hong Kong resulted in evisceration of all its citizens' freedoms. And people are learning now about the coercion in Xinjiang and how that has resulted in a punishable genocide, and the citizens don't like it, and is beginning to give the political will to government leaders and the CEOs to stand up to that China bully. It's the most unifying bipartisan issue on Capitol Hill. And all I know is, you know, we've all been bullied, right? Sometimes in our life. And all I know is when you confront a bully, they back down. But they really back down if you have your friends by your side. And by the way, they really, really back down if you have your friends by your side and you punch them in the nose. And that's what we need to do. We need to unite the world. And we need this next generation of transformational leaders, because things are changing so fast. We need honorable leaders, principled leaders. We need transformational leaders who can envision solutions for complex problems. That's really my quest.
If you had to choose one person, there's been many in your life, but one person has had an incredible impact. Who is that person? What did they teach you?
Well, for sure it would be my dad. I'll tell you a funny story. So, you know, I've always been fascinated with leadership. So I'm off at Harvard Business School, and there's just my first year. And there's a professor who teaches second year classes, and he's the guru for leadership. I try to get a one-on-one with him for a long time. Finally, I get it. I go into his office. He goes, "What are you here for?" I go, "I just have one question. What makes a great leader?" He goes, "Close your eyes." So I close my eyes. And he goes, "As soon as you can, just picture in your head, like, the leader you just follow, you know, just right, who's the leader, right in your mind." He goes, "You got it?" I go, "I got it." He goes, "Now, without opening your eyes, why is this person a great leader? You got it?" "Yeah, I got it." He goes, "You can open your eyes now." I go, "Okay." And he goes, "You know, I don't know the answer number one, but I can tell you the answer number two. By the way, I bet that person's fun to be around. They might even have a great sense of humor." And I go, "You're absolutely right. I mean, like, super fun. And the guy's probably funniest guy I know." He goes, "Just out of curiosity, who is it?" I go, "That's my father." He goes, "You have any more questions?" I go, "No." He goes, "You're dismissed." Right? Most important things are written in the book. And by the way, I remember my dad saying, he goes, he was a boxer in the Army. And we're sitting there drinking a beer one night. I think I was in college or something like that. And he goes, "Keith, you ever feel like you're like cornered in a ring? You're in a jam, you can't get out of it?" I go, "What do you mean, Dad?" He goes, "Yeah, no, you're cornered, you don't get that warm feeling. How am I going to get out?" I go, yeah. He goes, "You know, there's a way to get out of it every time." I go, "Well, what's that, Dad?" He goes, "It works every time." He goes, "Mock yourself out." He goes, "You know, I don't think he knew, like, with the word self-deprecating humor." He just goes, "Mock yourself out." He goes, "It gets you out every time." And he goes, and it's funny. Now, don't mock somebody else out, because you're going to hurt their feelings. Plus, it's not funny. You know what I mean? That's right. That's the kind of stuff.
I love it. What was the biggest challenge that you had to overcome in your own personal life? How'd you overcome it, and what did you learn from it?
Poof. I think there were...
There's been probably a lot, but what's one that stands out?
Yeah, there were a bunch of them. Well, I'll tell you one that really I struggled with. So when I left General Motors, you can imagine. I mean, I was a high potential candidate, youngest VP in history. I mean, they're tracking, right? And I leave. I leave everything behind. So I go out to the software... The startup company, a lot of people don't know about it. It was called Kronos. This was the first one. It actually wasn't RAS. And to be the number two guy at a software company. And my second day on the job, the CEO says, "This is what I want you to say at the next board meeting." And I go, "Marie, I will not say that. That would be lying." And I got that warm feeling in my stomach. Go, I just made the biggest, you know, mistake of my life. And because I knew we had different definitions of integrity, and I thought I could fix it. And I tried for about 9 months. And finally, this was when my first son was being born in the hospital. And IBM was a big investor in this company. You, by the way, it doesn't exist. It was Kronos with a Q. Nobody knows about it. And she kept calling me up. She goes, "You got to be here for IBM." I go, "I'm not missing the birth of my son." So after a couple of times, she'd call me, get me trying to come back. I just told her to do something that's anatomically impossible to do. And I said, I quit. And that was probably one of the greatest inflection points of my life, because I've been surrounded my whole life with a great set of values from family, Rocky River, General Motors, Purdue, all of that. And it was always before my very eyes. But I just took it granted everybody was. And I learned that's not true. So out of that experience, every company that I helped build or every organization I've been part of, it's always those set of values, and integrity is always, always at the forefront. And then that led to all these high tech companies and the government and stuff at Purdue and everything. So that, you know, my dad would say another thing too. He goes, when the world hands you a sour sack of shitty lemons, your job is to turn it into sweet lemonade. And by the way, that I think is that's a key quality for grit and adversity quotient, which are probably the two most important things. I'll take grit over brains or anything any day, because you know anybody can run the ball, you know, that first 80 yards down the goal line or 90, but when you're there close to the end zone to punch it in for the score, that's when it's the hardest, and that's when you got to get bloodied and bloodied on that battlefield. So anyway, I think that's a key part.
If you had to pick a book or podcast or something that's influenced your life that you'd recommend somebody go check out, what would you pick?
Well, The Art of War by Sun Tzu.
Good one. That's a good one. Yeah.
That's a good. By the way, ironically, I would. All the companies I built, I'd have, you know, because it's a short book, I'd have our folks read it. You know, it says stuff like, when you're strong, act weak. When you're weak, act strong. The highest paid guy in the army is the spy. Speed's the ultimate weapon. So I think that's one. You know, when I was, I think it was a high school, I read just a classic, Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People. That was a really interesting one for me. It got me fascinated in leadership, I think. I think that was a real groundbreaker. I think Ben Franklin's autobiography too.
Those are good.
So
that was a good recommendation.
And of course, your podcast, that's actually my favorite now.
I appreciate your kind, but that's I'm in the shadows of giants compared to all the books that you just you just listed off. But one day.
But they all started with a podcast, and you know it, Scott.
Whatever their version of a podcast was way back then.
Yeah, I was talking to people.
Yeah, just talking to this is why
just talking talk to the people. Yeah. Talk to the people.
If you could tell your 20-year-old self one thing, what would it be?
I mean, so many things are running through my head. I think I would say, don't get too high on the highs and don't get too low on the lows. Everything's going to even out.
Good advice.
You know, and... You know, when things are going really good, you best be looking over your shoulder, because there might be a freight train coming. And when you're just down in the dumps, look, tomorrow's a new day. And I mean, I've experienced some things where it's like, hey, man, the CNN trucks might be on, you know, your front lawn, you know, tomorrow, who knows? You know, that I've been curled up at a desk in a fetal position. You know, as a CEO, you're guaranteed to do it at least once a quarter. So it's like, hey, man, you're going to see it through. And your safety net is your faith and your family and your friends at the end of the day. And that's what really gives you the courage to put it out on the line and get bloodied.
And then last question, what does success mean to you?
I think, as I said before, I think it's paying it forward. That's, and seeing what my, you know, seeing my grandchildren, like my dad said, you never know if you're a good father until you see your children's children. I just got two of them.
Congratulations.
And thank you. Thank you. It's great. It's a great feeling. And I've got these 10-year-old twins, man. They're dynamite. Emma and JD. I mean, they are fun. They come up with the funniest things. And then I also think, too, in the business world, you know, like a company like Ariba, I think we spawned 12 public company CEOs. So to see those guys do really great, I think that's my definition of success. My other definition of success is that my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren will be able to live free, because that is not a given. And that I want more than anything else.
I know a lot of entrepreneurs listen to this show, and NetSuite has been a huge supporter for entrepreneurs, for business owners, because there's one thing that we all know. Business is about making money, and it's about your bottom line. And the less you spend on the nuts and bolts of running your business, the more profits you keep. But these days, everything is costing more. Supplies, people, shipping. It squeezes your margins, and I've been there, juggling multiple systems for finance, inventory, you name it. Each with its own costs and its own set of headaches. That's why I made the switch to NetSuite by Oracle. It's changed our company. Think about it. NetSuite is one of the top financial systems out there. It puts your whole business on one platform: accounting, finance, the works. One data source for everyone. There's no more mismatched info. And because it's in the cloud, it slashes your IT costs. No more servers, no more updates. Just access NetSuite from anywhere. With one integrated suite, your overhead drops big time. And here's the real win: efficiency. Everything's connected in NetSuite. Costs are ridiculous lately. Find a proven way to reduce your expenses and get better performance out of your team. It's a no-brainer, and that's what NetSuite offers. Over 37,000 companies have figured this out already. You have to join them. Right now, through to April 15th, NetSuite's got an incredible, flexible financing plan. Check it out and see the savings yourself at netsuite.com/ScottClary. That's netsuite.com/ScottClary. Hiring as a small business owner is a major pain. That's why LinkedIn is supporting today's episode. You need people with the right skills and experience, but finding them can take forever. It is incredibly frustrating to keep seeing candidates who just aren't a good fit, and that's why LinkedIn Jobs has been a game changer. Let me tell you a little story. We needed to hire a graphic designer, somebody with specific tech and software knowledge and the ability to truly understand our brand. And I started with all the usual job boards, and it's the same old story. Tons of irrelevant applications. No one's really matching my needs. I tried LinkedIn Jobs, and the quality of candidates was just on another level. People with impressive portfolios, relevant expertise. I finally felt like I was interviewing the right people. That's truly the power of LinkedIn's massive professional network. You're tapping into this huge pool of talent you simply wouldn't find on other sites. It's about finding those niche candidates you actually need. And with the right people in front of you, hiring becomes a breeze. Did you know that 86% of small businesses find a qualified candidate on LinkedIn Jobs within 24 hours? That is how well their system works. Honestly, do yourself a favor and try LinkedIn Jobs next time you're hiring. You can post your job for free at linkedin.com/excellence. That's linkedin.com/excellence. Terms and conditions apply, but it's definitely worth trying out.
I don't know about you, but the idea of being harassed, scammed, or even worse, all because somebody found my personal information online, that's terrifying. Our political opinions, our addresses, even stuff about our families, it's out there for anyone to grab. And did you know that data brokers are allowed to sell information on over 98% of Americans? It's scary stuff. That's why I've partnered with Delete Me. I personally use Delete Me. They're a big friend of the podcast because I put myself out there online. So safety is a huge concern. It's really scary how easy it is to find someone's details and information, but Delete Me creates a layer of protection that we all need. You tell Delete Me what you want gone, and they make it disappear from those sketchy data broker sites. And Delete Me doesn't stop. They constantly monitor the web to keep your information off those lists. It's like having a privacy watchdog that never sleeps. You need to take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me. They're giving a special discount for all Success Story podcast listeners. Get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/success and use promo code success at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/success and enter code success at checkout. joindeleteme.com/success. Hey everyone, I just want to take a second and thank the sponsor of today's episode, Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond Bourbon. Now, I don't have a lot of liquor sponsors on this show. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond is actually one of my favorites. I've drank it for a few years now, and this is why we actually decided to work together. Heaven Hill Distillery, family-owned since 1935, is a great entrepreneur story too. So there's five brothers. They filled their first whiskey barrels back in 1935, and their legacy still lives on today. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond is aged over 7 years. That's three more than required by the Bottled and Bond Act of 1897. This means the best quality, the best purity, and the best consistency. This is not just average bourbon. It's the winner of the double gold medals at multiple 2023 World Spirits competitions, and they've won the very prestigious Triple Still Award. It's a very big deal in the liquor and bourbon world. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond boasts an exceptionally smooth oak flavor, while its aroma offers a sweet blend of caramel and smooth vanilla. If you love bourbon, you need to try Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond. Available nationally, look for a bottle at your local store. Heaven Hill reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely. Think back to your last few days in the office. Did any of them leave you feeling really accomplished? Not the kind of day where you're running around like crazy, but where you've made real progress on something that matters. Because being busy doesn't always mean being productive, and I bet you we've all been there, and maybe it's time to rethink what it means to get things done. Today's episode is sponsored by Belay, and what they help you do is, instead of getting sucked into emails and to-do lists, they help you delegate tasks and focus on big goals. They can connect you with top-notch US-based talent who are ready to take on those time-consuming tasks that bog you down. Let's be real. There are way more important things you could be doing than bookkeeping or wrangling a packed inbox. They have virtual assistants to handle all of those pesky administrative tasks or accounting professional to take care of all your financials. But here's the best part. You don't have to waste weeks searching for the right person. Belay's personalized matching service works quickly, sometimes matching you with the right talent to take stuff off your plate in under a week. Are you ready to try a different way of working? Check out Belay's list of the top 25 things you can delegate to a virtual assistant. It might just change your business and your life. Text SUCCESS, that's SUCCESS, to 55123 to get the list and to start transforming your to-do list with Belay.